Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to a podcast from the BBC World Service. This is Hard Talk with me, Stephen Sacker. Thanks for downloading this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. My guest today has become something of an international spokesman for a community with a long and proud tradition, but an uncertain future. Bishop Angelos is the General Bishop of the Coptic Church in the United Kingdom. His homeland is Egypt, where Coptic Christians have had a significant presence for most of the last 2,000 years. Today it's thought that around 10% of Egypt's 90 million people are Copts, but the figure is both unreliable and said to be declining. Every year, significant numbers leave the country in the face of sectarian violence and systematic discrimination. Just before Easter, close to 50 Copts were killed in so-called Islamic State attacks on two churches. Those attacks carried grim echoes of the suffering of Christians in other parts of the Middle East, Syria and Iraq in particular. Across the region, there's been a dramatic and sustained decline in the numbers of Christians. In just a few days, Pope Francis will fly to Egypt to lend his support to the Coptic community. But in the longer term, do Christians have a sustainable future in the Middle East? Well, Bishop Angelos joins me now. Welcome to Hard Talk.
Thank you.
Do you think there is something substantively different about the nature of the threat faced by Coptic Christians in Egypt today? Because they've faced threats for many, many years.
Well, yes, we've faced threats for centuries, and particularly over the past decades. But to have suicide bombers in churches is a shift. And it looks like the mirroring of attacks in other parts of the world. And I think that's why it's shocked the Egyptian community generally so much, Christians and Muslims. We haven't seen this level of aggression and violence. We've had attacks which have been equally painful, but this does mark a very new chapter.
And does that mean, I mean, since we saw the, as you say, the suicide bomb attacks on two churches, the cathedral in Alexandria, the church in Tanta, does that mean that Christian communities have to think more carefully than they have before about self-protection?
Well, of course. We saw a heightened security around the churches in lead up to the Easter celebrations. The community is resilient, it's strong, it's very faithful in its worship, it's very forgiving, but it does have to be more careful. I've said in the past week that what is ironic is that these churches were attacked when they were full, and that was after only 2 months after the bombing in Cairo. So it hasn't dissuaded people from going to church.
Well, you talk about resilience, and I appreciate, as you've just said, that those churches are still being filled. But there are signs that Egyptian Copts are scared in a new way. I'm thinking of what we've seen in El Arish, a small town in northern Sinai, where the so-called IS group made explicit threats, saying, we are going to come after you, Christians, and we are going to kill you. And we saw some deaths, but we also saw many Christians fleeing, leaving the community altogether. Do you believe that that is an inevitable response, that that was the sensible response?
Well, at that time, it definitely was the right response, because they had been undergoing attacks for weeks leading up to that. But at that point, they realized they had no more sustainable presence there and their families were at risk. So they moved to surrounding dioceses that absorbed them. I don't think I would use the word fear. I don't think I've heard any of our church leadership or indeed our community use the word fear, but they are concerned and they have every right to protect their families. They did that in this particular instance by leaving, but they remain targeted because they can't all become internally displaced.
An interesting phrase used by one of your colleagues, Bishop Macarius of Minya Diocese. He said, we can now consider ourselves to be living through a wave of persecution. Is this an era of outright sustained persecution, in your view?
I think we've lived a history of persecution throughout our presence in Egypt, and it's intensified at various times in our contemporary history, ever since the presence of President, the former President Sadat, when Islamists were given a slightly greater reign. And so they started to divide up the community in that way. Christians became a more visible and more legitimate target for them.
It's a fault line, isn't it? I mean, it seems to me, and I'm looking at the analysis of experts in Islamism in Egypt, like Naji Shorab, he says, the intent here is to make a separation between Muslims and Christians and to start an outright religious conflict in Egypt. That is what the so-called Islamic State is all about. Can they succeed?
I don't think so. They haven't so far. So whether it was after the bombing in Cairo or these bombings, Egypt is very different to the rest of the Middle East. There isn't a tribal presence there. It's much more a homogenous presence. And in actual fact, what we see after every one of these attacks is a greater support from the greater Muslim community because they see themselves and their communities as targeted as well. So it doesn't make us more marginalized. The outpouring of support and shock that we've seen in the community, both in Egypt and globally as a result, is a telltale sign of
that. Well, to that extent, you strike me as an optimist, but you could flip your argument around and say it is striking the degree to which the state, personified, of course, by President Sisi, but by the machinery of the state, still doesn't take what would seem to me to be basic structural measures to ensure that the long-term discrimination against Coptic Christians in Egypt is addressed. You know, there's the short term, there's the three-month emergency, there's, I think, a specific new law about church construction. But many Copts say, you know, what about what is taught in schools? What about the horrible extremism that comes from some mosques? Why are these things not addressed?
I think we're starting to see that addressed in the past few months, and I think it's going to take a generation. This sort of thought process has infiltrated the education system, the general society, so much that it has to be replaced by something else. So the curricula have to change, the sense of citizenship, it has to change, and Christians have to be seen as part of that fundamental presence and as indigenous people who are living alongside their Muslim brethren as well.
I've spent time reporting for Hard Talk in Upper Egypt. Some of the towns around Aswan, Minya, other towns along the Nile, going all the way down south, you still find many communities where Christians do feel that their security is constantly under threat. And the government knows it, but still doesn't seem to do much about it.
That has been the weak point. So at the national level, I think we're hearing very legitimate, very sincere promises from the president, from the government, from the national security services. But when one comes down to the local level, to the villages, to the districts, where there's a sense of impunity because crimes go unreported sometimes because they realize that there's not going to be investigated properly, there'll be no replies, there'll be no convictions. And so therefore, there's a ratcheting up. There's an intensification of the kind of attack, and it becomes more deadly every time.
And the question is, at local level, at municipal level, regional, and then national level, how many Coptic Christians are in positions of real authority, say in the judiciary, say actually in local government? You know, you're a Copt with a great knowledge of your country. Can you hand on heart say that your community is represented in the machinery of government and justice?
Oh, absolutely not. And that's been the problem over the past decades. There is most definitely a glass ceiling. And it's not because there aren't enough Christians or not intelligent enough or not specialized enough, because what we see is them leaving the public sector and going into the private sector and becoming very, very successful. And that in itself creates a greater resentment because they're seen as being successful. So I do think as part of this overall solution and the sense of citizenship, there needs to be a greater representation and the understanding that Christians can be productive, sincere, faithful members of a community and be people who can work side by side with Muslims.
But
Bishop, is not one of the problems that you and other senior leaders in the church, including the current Pope, but also Pope Shenouda, whom, of course, you worked for a while in the past, you as a collective group at the top of the church have year upon year been in the pocket of Egypt's rulers. And I'm thinking of Mubarak, and now I'm thinking of Sisi. And obviously it wasn't the case when the Muslim Brotherhood was in power, but you celebrated when Sisi came back to power. And the danger is that yet again, you're making the same mistake. You in the church are allying yourself with an authoritarian leader.
Well, I don't think we've been in anyone's pocket, because the church, in the very literal sense, is self-funded, it is self-protected, it is self-governing. We haven't received any greater benefits by supporting anyone. If we look across the presidencies in the past, we've been attacked equally throughout. And I think we need to change the paradigm of this conversation a little bit, because I think Christians in Egypt, as in anywhere, have a right to express their allegiances to whichever political leadership or party they see will hold their interests without reprisal. And I think that's very important. But it can't be a justification.
Yeah, but a lot of Copts in Egypt today, I've been looking at the blogs, looking at social media, they are frustrated that you at the top of the church do seem to be knee-jerk loyal to the president of the country, Mr. al-Sisi. For example, while Iskander, who blogs frequently on Coptic issues, he's actually questioned the current Pope's fidelity to the Coptic creed. He said the Pope and the church right now show very little love except to the regime itself. I mean, he is very resentful.
I know where I've communicated with Wael in the past. I agree with his frustration, but I don't think it's about loyalty. I think it's about alternative. So let's assume we don't support the current president of Sisi. What's the alternative? We saw in the past presidency our cathedral, for the first time in living history, being attacked in the sight of security forces who were standing, looking on, doing absolutely nothing. So that wasn't a viable option. What we can also realize is, if you're looking at the landscape, who is going to hold the interests of not only Christians, but Egyptians as a whole? If there was an alternative, I would say yes, of course,
but,
that's the alternative.
This is a council of despair. You're saying we have to collaborate with authoritarians, because if we don't do that, we have no protection at all. We are completely defenseless. But Christians, I dare say, felt the similar sort of thing in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, maybe in Bashar al-Assad's Syria. But look what's happened to Christians in those two countries, because when the dam breaks, when the authoritarian loses his grip, because of the quote-unquote collaboration, Christians are in even more danger, aren't they?
Of course, Christians are in danger anyway. Over the past decades, we've seen that. And I don't think it is a blind allegiance. It is an informed choice, because one looks at the options.
Or a lack of choice.
Absolutely. One looks at the options. And when in 30th of September, when Egyptians came out into the street, they were by no means only Christians. There was a huge spectrum. Yet, when we see police officers killed, soldiers killed, no one asks where they were on the 30th, no one asks what their political support is, they realize they are targeted because they're police officers or soldiers or anything else. So Christians are being targeted by this fringe just because they are Christians. And I think no matter what the political affiliation would be, they would still be a target, because there is an intolerance of the presence of Christians by this fringe element within Egypt.
But you could speak out more. I mean, I'm giving you the chance, I suppose, in this interview to speak out about President Sisi. A bunch of intellectuals, Coptic intellectuals, at the time that he went to New York for the last UN General Assembly, they issued a statement, quite a condemnatory statement about Sisi, saying, despite the warm relationship between the current regime and the Egyptian churches, that would be, you know, church leaders like yourself, ordinary Christian citizens day by day still suffer from discrimination. You have an opportunity here to say, Mr. Sisi, President Sisi, your stand, your words about helping us, supporting and protecting us are not backed by actions, and it's not good enough.
But we have said that, and I think it would be naive of any of the analysts to think that we don't make demands and we don't stand by our people. We have nothing to benefit except the interests of our people, and we do make demands, whether it was for the people in Arish or people who are being attacked on a daily basis. And I think it's important, so myself as a bishop, as a pastor, do make these things. We've made them directly to the government through the diplomatic corps, and we have nothing to fear in making these claims.
As a background to this, it's striking to me that Pope Tawadros describe the Arab Spring itself, you know, which was, let's remember, in 2011, a surge of people across the region taking to the streets in support of democratic change and reform. He described the Arab Spring as, quote, not a spring, but a winter plotted by malicious hands. Again, is that a place where Christians in the region want to be against that surge of popular support for reform and change and the end to authoritarianism?
No one is against reform, absolutely. But I think we saw what was going to happen. We saw, knowing Egypt, knowing the political landscape, knowing the mentality and dynamic, that once this leader was gone, there would become a political vacuum. That vacuum would be filled by people who may not have the interest of country at heart. And of course, what happened is we saw the greatest number of attacks within those 2 years than we had for the previous 20 years, because it was an anarchic state, but as well because there was a sense of empowerment of those who were on the fringes and didn't really want to think about anyone else. The thing about democracy is it's not a means in itself, it's a means to an end. And I think that end is that a democracy is only as strong as it is able to protect its smallest unit. Mm.
Let me ask you about the visit of Pope Francis. You know, we've been discussing how the local church, the Coptic church, finesses its relationship to the state and to power in a very troubled atmosphere in Egypt today. What do you want from Pope Francis? How robust do you want his message to the Egyptian government and the Egyptian people to be?
I think on record, Pope Francis has been very robust in his message in support of Christians not only in Egypt but across the Middle East and indeed many persecuted people around the world. It's the Christian message of equality and sanctity of life and dignity of life. And I think that is the message that people will get. He's going primarily to visit his own constituency but also support the Christians of Egypt and at the invitation of Al-Azhar to look into the Christian-Muslim dialogue on violent extremism. So I think that voice going into that dialogue as well, that conversation is going to be important, saying it's not about conferences, it's not about dialogues anymore. It is about taking ownership of the texts that are being used by the caliphate and affiliates to manipulate Muslims who could otherwise be very good Muslims to use violence against peaceful, peace-loving, forgiving people. So I, as a Christian, have spoken to
Do you think Muslims are going to take lectures from Christian leaders like
no.
Pope Francis?
And that's why I'm saying the nature of the dialogue now is to try to speak to our Muslim friends in leadership to say they need to take this ownership of their own text, which some are doing around the world.
There are Western Christian leaders and commentators who fear that the fate of Christians in Egypt could, in years to come, have horrible similarities to the fate of Christians in Iraq and Syria. Of course, in Iraq, we've seen, I think, in the period since 2003, 80% of all Christians in the country either killed or leave. In Syria, the figures are getting close as well. I mean, the Christian community is almost eliminated. Could that happen in Egypt?
It's going to be more difficult. There is going to be a great pressure. This is not the end. This is only a beginning of a campaign.
Your numbers are going down, aren't they? I mean, it's always a very grey area how many Coptic Christians there are in Egypt. Some say 10% of 90 million, that would be 9 million. Others say it's fewer than that. But the numbers seem to be going down.
The numbers will tend to be somewhere between 9 and 13. Our position is it's about 15%.
Oh, really?
But I think what we've seen is because it's such a bulk, it's very difficult to get the drop that we've seen in other places. For every 5 Christians in the Middle East, 4 are in Egypt. Mm. So Egyptians now represent 80% of all the Christian presence, which means they become a significantly greater target and they live under greater pressure. There will be some who leave, but I can't imagine we will have that amount of hemorrhaging that we've seen in other places. Because what used to happen is there'd be persecution in one place and a person would go to a neighboring Middle Eastern country. We have a series of failed states. The only way out is Europe and North America, and that's becoming more and more difficult.
Let me ask you about a word that is so sensitive and so important to this debate. The former Archbishop of Canterbury, George Carey, used it in an article the other day, and that word is genocide. He says that we have to acknowledge and report what is happening to Christians in the Middle East as a genocide, and that there are clear moral and legal imperatives, therefore, to intervene on the part of Western nations and international nations, not just Western nations. Is that word relevant? Is it, in your view, the right word for what is happening to Christians?
Absolutely. We've seen that happen in Iraq, in Libya, attempts in Syria, and of course at a much smaller scale, but that's happening now in Egypt, from this radical fringe. I was very much part of the campaign that went on in the United States before declaration of genocide there by Congress, by the State Department, and I was very happy to hear our parliament here be very much in line with that. And I think it's really our responsibility. As a minister, as a Christian, I need to look at the interests of people as well. I would be very, very tribal and very hypocritical if I was just to look at Christians in Egypt, if I didn't look at Christians across the Middle East, and also even people like the Yazidis who've been persecuted. There is a trend of a very narrowing scope, a narrowing perspective going through the Middle East that only certain people have a right to exist. And we need, in conscience, to address that, not creating enmity with anyone.
But with respect, if it's a word you say is entirely apposite and the right word, then what on earth is your view of Western political leaders who are not intervening?
There has been a deafening silence over the past decades. And I think we've seen that starting to break recently. It's, some will say, too little, too late, but it's not too late for the people who are still there and who are still suffering. So whatever we can do, even at this late stage, we need to try to do.
Interesting you talk about those people who are still there and still suffering. There is also a debate about them, because frankly, it seems to me in Iraq and in Syria too, even those who are still there are making plans to escape and see no future for themselves in either country. They think the Christian experience presence in those countries is over. And yet, we have Christian leaders, and I'm now going to quote you words from a couple of years back from Gregory III, the patriarch of the Melkite Church in Antioch, Alexandria, and Jerusalem. That's his formal position. He wrote this open letter to his own flock in Syria saying, "Despite all your suffering, stay here. Do not emigrate. We exhort the faithful. Call them to patience in spite of the tribulations, in spite of the tsunami of destructive, bloody, tragic crises. Jesus tells us," he finished, "fear not." Do you, as religious Christian leaders, have a right to tell your flock not to flee in the face of all of this?
Well, the patriarch has every right to approach his own people the way he thinks fitting. But my view...
But what's your view of whether that is the right thing to say to ordinary Christian people facing the reality of life and death in Iraq and Syria today?
It's exactly that. It is facing the reality. I don't think I should put the burden on a single individual anywhere in the Middle East for the continuance of Christianity and have him or her stay there at a personal cost because of that. I think people need to make a personal decision. If they think they have a viable presence and existence, we need to support them to stay there safe and dignified. But if they need to leave, if they think, because they will decide on the interests and safety of their own children and families, then we need to provide a safe passage. But I don't think we can prescribe that to
Bishop, them. Bishop, what would you do if it was you and your family in Iraq or Syria today?
Difficult to know. If I was by myself, as a celibate monk as I am, I would probably stay. If I had to look after a family with vulnerable people, children, elderly people, I would look after their interests. And that's why I'm saying it's a very particular, personal decision that we can't take away from people. They need to make those decisions for themselves and to be able to assure their life. We live here in freedom and dignity and safety. And I don't think I should expect less of anybody in the world.
Bishop Angelos, thank you very much for being on Hard Talk.
Thank you.
That was an edition of Hard Talk presented by me, Stephen Sacker. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
I knew right at that moment that my whole life was gone. I'm going to jail for a very, very long time. There was no doubt about it.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast with astonishing personal stories from across the globe.
And honestly, even at that point of reporting to a journalist, I don't think I really knew that that was in itself an act of whistleblowing.
Expect the unexpected.
The only future is death here. So if we live, we might have a chance. We will die anyway, but we will die trying.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.